Welcome back, welcome back. I'm Lawrence Brown, and you're listening to your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that was He's So Fine by the Chiffons. And on this day in 1963, the Chiffons started a four-week run, stop laughing, Maricela, at number one with this single. Call in with your comments. Y'all already know the number, 410-319-8888. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. The producers will get the comments to me. Comment on our Facebook page or send us an email at steinershow.org. And we're blessed to have in the studio today Dee Watkins, the author, filmmaker, and professor at Coppin State University. He's also a writer for Salon.com. We'll be discussing his piece today. We're also happy to have Dr. Tanya Sanders, who's an assistant professor in the Graduate City and Regional Planning Program and the Graduate Department of Built Environment Studies at Morgan State's School of Architecture and Planning. We're also happy to be joined by Dr. Maricela Gomez, physician, community activist, and author of Race, Class, Power, and Organizing in East Baltimore, Rebuilding America's Abandoned Cities. And finally, we're joined in the studio by Donald Gresham, East Baltimore resident and the co-founder of the Baltimore Redevelopment Action Coalition for Empowerment, or BRACE. Good morning to each of you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning.
Yes, yes, yes. So, again, you can reach us at 410-319-8888. Dee Watkins, we're going to start with you this morning. You wrote this piece in Salon, and it's gotten a lot of feedback, we understand. But I would love for you to talk about what it is that you were conveying in the article that's pertinent to what's happening in Black Baltimore today.
I think one of the major issues that, you know, that some people, a lot of people liked the article and then a lot of people didn't. And I think some of the people who didn't like the article, one of the main things that they missed is, you know, saying yes to something is always saying no to something else. Mm. So it's like, I'm not a person who's going to sit here. If you're like some white person from Idaho, mm-hmm. and you move, you know, on Miami Street and you buy a home and you're making money and it's working for you and your family wants to come in and you building, that's you. That's mm-hmm. your life. You can do whatever you want to do. But I have a right to get upset if, you know, some of the neighborhoods where I share most of my childhood memories that are gone. I have a right to, you know, talk about how a lot of opportunities that come into the city only come after you displace all these Black families. Like, that's my right. If you're for displacement and that makes you happy, I'm not attacking you, but I have a right to feel how I feel. So my message was basically, you know, why does it seem like so much opportunity always just comes into the city when you take Black people off of Iger Street and throw them in Harford County?
Absolutely.
You know, that's my thing.
And for those of you that don't know, his piece was called Black History Bulldozed for Another Starbucks Against the New Baltimore.
That wasn't my idea, because
right.
there's no star. Then no that I know. I don't mm-hmm. know of any Starbucks. That was Solange's thing. So
right.
like, you know, a lot of people was like, well, where's the Starbucks at? And Black people like Starbucks too.
Right.
You know?
Right. But you did mention three places, three specific locations. You said Lafayette Housing Projects.
Yeah.
Somerset Courts, uh-huh. and Wolf and Eager Street, which is in the Middle East community. Donald, I want to go to you now because you live near Wolf and Eager Streets, and you can tell us about the Middle East community that Dee mentioned in his article, which was reconfigured by the East Baltimore Development Initiative, EBDI, Johns Hopkins, and the City of Baltimore. What has the displacement of your community meant to you?
You know, it's interesting to watch people drawing out, you know, leaving the community like cattle. It was very sad to watch elderly population not be able to live through the process because they just couldn't handle the move. And to leave almost 740 families out of a community and then promise them that they could come back, but yet you're only building houses that are like 280,000 or 225,000. But you have never said anything about the historical residents that were in the place. So it's interesting that they come with a process, and as the young man had already said, the reality of it is you always got to move folk out. And we thought that was crazy because they had many, many houses that were remaining standing. Of course, they bulldozed a lot of the houses down and left them dormant, left them just there. waiting for the next project they were planning in Baltimore, in the Middle East area. So, yeah, I'm angry and upset about it as well, because I see that residents cannot return to a community that financially they could never afford.
And, D, you had a line in here that I really fell in love with. You said, "We did stupid things, but that was our community, the place where our social networks were birthed and then quickly dismantled. That whole block is gone. I realized that I may never see any of those people from that place again. As 10 shirtless white guys play two-hand touch football in a fresh park that they would never build for us. A huge Johns Hopkins logo was the backdrop." And Maricel, I want to turn to you. You've written a powerful book on this, what happened in East Baltimore. What is it that happens to a community? What happens to black communities when they lose their neighborhood?
Yeah. Well, I think East Baltimore, Middle East Baltimore, like Donald said, is a really, really great example of what happens to communities when you disrupt them. And I think Mindy Fully Love's work is really key in all this when she talks about serial forced displacement. A researcher at Michigan, I believe, Geronimo's, she's also talked a lot about the weathering effect. And I think these things are really important as we look at how historically, serially, continuously we've had chronic displacement of African descendant, Afro descendant people in the U.S. Baltimore, Middle East Baltimore, is a great example of this weathering, meaning over and over and over again, the same group of people, black, low-income people, are forced to leave their homes, leave their roots, leave their communities. And the cumulative effect of that stress, we haven't even begun to look at. We won't even acknowledge it. It's only in the past 10 years or a little over that we have started to acknowledge that this continuous serial force displacement, this process of moving people against their will, has an effect. And in the long term, leads to some of these huge health disparities and wealth disparities that we're experiencing today, these huge gaps that we see both in health of people of color and white people and people with assets and resources and people without, and also in the wealth and health. They go together. They're not this disparate. They're not different. So in communities like Middle East Baltimore that Dee Watkins and Donald mentioned, these communities suffer huge tolls from being displaced against their will. No one is really that interested in looking at what the effects of that is. No one is really interested in looking at what was the effect of urban renewal in the 50s and 60s. No one's interested in looking at mass displacement before then. We're not really interested in understanding what is the effect of these oppressive exploitation of communities that have been abandoned, disinvested to a stage where they're vulnerable and easily preyed upon by the likes of people with power, such as Hopkins, such as the Annie E. Casey Foundation, such as the city power wielders, and really anyone who has the power to come in and negotiate to further their assets on the back of those without.
And I want to go next to you, Dr. Sanders. You know, in urban planning, what is it that comes to mind for you when you're hearing all of this? Is this the way urban planning should take place? You know, is there a different way?
Yes, there is a different way. So one of the things that immediately comes to mind when I looked at how Baltimore was developing, particularly in disinvested communities, that there was another choice. You could have done revitalization without displacement. That will take a longer time to do, because it's easy to bulldoze something and put up something new and beautiful, glass, right, as compared to working with the community, finding out what some of their barriers are, whether that's education, workforce development. It could be childcare. It could be health outcomes. That takes time. That takes heart. That takes going, you know, door to door, engaging the community, figuring out that, having those town hall meetings and things and pulling them into the process. One of the things that I was kind of struck by reading your website was that the inclusion of the community didn't come until there was actually a fight for it.
You're referring to Dr. Gomez's website,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. yes. And to me, that was like, you wouldn't need so much police presence after the new buildings and things go up if people were involved in the process from the beginning, because they own that change. Mm-hmm. And when you own that change, you're not going to let every knucklehead come around and mess up that change. People will police themselves, mm-hmm. because they have the invested stake in what in the change that they helped bring about. And so there were some missed opportunities, that's for sure.
Now, Maricela, you talked about in your book that planning for people at EBDI and Hopkins, they engaged in the charrettes, and for them it was like a game, but for the community it wasn't a game. And I thought that was very powerful, how you talked about that in your book. Let's go to one of our callers right now. Bruce from Baltimore, you're on the Mark Steiner Show. Welcome.
Yeah, good morning. I appreciate taking my phone call. So, you know, there's always been development, and have some black neighborhoods change, of course. But you know what? This is nothing new. So, you know what? There was a charrette several years ago on O'Donnell Heights, and I got involved in that. And you know what? I'm for a certain type of development, and it's not necessarily to destroy the black neighborhood. It's not some conspiracy. You want to play that game, that's fine. But let's... all neighborhoods change. My neighborhoods change, you know, so that's the way it is, whether it's black or white, whatever it is. So right away, John Hopkins is the big bad bully.
No one was ever displaced in Roland Park. No one was ever displaced from Canton.
Since you guys have a beautiful day.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you, Bruce. Bruce from Baltimore, one of the regular callers here to the Mark Steiner Show. I do want to mention a couple of statistics because I think Bruce's point is quite interesting. But, you know, I looked at the history over the weekend, and approximately 14,911 black families have been forced to relocate due to slum clearance, urban renewal, and the two Hopkins-led displacement projects here in Baltimore. That's 14,000, nearly 15,000 black families. And if you, if each of those families had an average of four people apiece, mm-hmm. then you're talking about 80,000, mm-hmm. 80,000 people at least involved in that. Now, here are a couple of other statistics. Since 2000, Baltimore ranks 15th in the percentage of eligible census tracts that have gentrified. Ranks 15th in the nation in the number percentage of eligible census tracts that have gentrified. And we rank 35th in the decline of the percentage of black people at the center of the city between 1990 and 2012. So clearly, D, you're not just talking about something that's not real. The numbers are actually backing up that not only is it happening now, but there's a historical sense to what's been taking place.
You know, and people, you hop on the internet and, you know, they say that, you know, things like gentrification in Baltimore has done nothing to hurt black neighborhoods. With a straight face.
Right.
You know?
And there's, I know, a Poppleton community on the other side of MLK from the University of Maryland, when they built the biopark over there, the Daily Record mentioned how the housing values for those homes begin to go through the roof. And there's literally a line in one of the articles where the author says, or quoting one of the persons that they interviewed, that they're looking for a better type of person to live over there, which will help the community gentrify even further. And so, and there used to be a larger percentage of black folks that lived in the Inner Harbor, that lived near Canton. And when the highway to nowhere, that ended up going nowhere, mm-hmm. but when that was announced, they ended up displacing a lot of families over there. So, you know, there are real instances where this is taking place.
Yeah, and it's like even, you know, first of all, we have to understand how important communities are. And, you know, some of these social networks that we speak about. But even beyond that, what about, so I knew a woman who lived on Durham, right off of Iggy Street on Durham before they tore Durham down. And she went to that church on the corner on Caroline Street. And she went to the cleaners at Church Square. And she went to that shopping market. And she had a husband who died. And she buried him. And that was their house. And, you know, her whole existence, she could walk and navigate through that neighborhood to get to everything she had to get to. And then, you know, when they come through with these new plans and she gets left out, you know, she's out in the county somewhere by like a Best Buy. Like, she can't survive in that. That's like, that's culture shock. And these people who make these decisions, they don't care about families. They don't care about elderly people who need these communities to thrive. They don't care about that stuff. They care about, getting rid of the undesirables so that, you know, they can have whatever they want to have. And, you know, I just agree with everyone else said on the panel. You can do these things without shipping people all over the place. No, but we know what it is. Let's not tiptoe around it. We know what it is.
Can I jump in here?
Sure.
One of the things I just wanted to say was that I actually agree with the caller to a point. Mm-hmm. Neighborhoods do change. Mm-hmm. But it's a difference between something that's an organic change, you know, people moving in, moving out, births, deaths in the community, as compared to this dramatic, abrupt, really disruptive type of change. Mm-hmm. And so those are things that we need to delineate between what yes, communities change, but it's a gradient in the types of changes.
Right. Now, I want to go back because, like I said, Dee, you mentioned three specific locations in your article, Lafayette Housing Project, Somerset Courts, and Wolf and Eager Streets. Now, two out of those three are housing developments that were built by the Housing Authority of Baltimore City. And so with what you said, Dr. Sanders, to what degree did the Housing Authority of Baltimore City include mm-hmm. these black residents in their planning, right? To what degree were they allowed to engage in that process so that mm-hmm. they could say, here's what we want for ourselves, our community? Did they want to be sent out to the county? Mm-hmm. You know, and Dr. Gomez, you mentioned Dr. Fully Love's work. Thank you. What she talks about root shock. Mm-hmm. What is root shock and how... What does it mean, not just for health, but for the community, to lose your community?
So Dr. Fully Love talks about root shock, and I think the example she gives is really awesome. So she says, if you take a plant and you take it out of its soil and now you try to transplant it somewhere else, inevitably that plant is going to have a root shock, meaning the roots have been pulled up out of its home, out of its soil that's been nurturing it. And now you're going to take that and you're going to transfer it. And the effect of that uprooting, she then compares and she makes an analogy to what happens when we uproot communities of color that have been historically together, all the social networks. You know, those roots, they're not just rooted into the earth on their own. They're connected. They have little tiny roots that continue in very long ways to connect to other roots. And that's exactly the picture that we have when we uproot communities, particularly like Donald said, when you take the elderly who have been in those communities, and like Dee Watkins said, the elderly who are now moved out to Hartford Road or Bel Air, who don't know the area, who've been in East Baltimore for a long time, or any of these communities that they've grown up in. And now you drop them there, they're 60 or 70 years old, their connection. You know, I've followed up with a lot of residents of the 700 families who were displaced by EBDI Casey Hopkins Project. They're not happy. They might have been moved into a house for a house with similar housing value, but they're talking about they're not seeing folks who they knew for years. The only time they hear about someone is when they hear that they died, and then they're happy to go to the funeral because that's the only time they get to see folks from the past. So there's this real culture disruption. There's this social network. And as we all know, it's the social ties that bind us. It's the good morning neighbor. It's the hey friend. It's the knowing someone down the road. If something happens in front of my stoop that day, I'm going to find out later that night. That's the connections and social networks that keep us going, that nurtures our heart and our soul and our spirit. When you uproot that without any disrespect, without any inclusivity for what's going to happen to my community, you're causing so much damage to the mental and the physical and the spirit of the individual and of the community and of communities that have been historically disenfranchised. So we can talk about this uprooting and root shock, not just in East Baltimore and in communities like this, but in any place where people have been forced to move against their will. And so we're talking about chronic trauma
right.
that we have not healed from the past, and all we're doing is layering and layering and layering. So until we figure out, like Dr. Saunders say, a different way to do community revitalization, and we know there's a way. You know, there's a way to do it. We have examples. We have models of how it's been done correctly. However, when the economic goalpost has been set for a certain group and race and class of people, then anything in the way has to be removed. So, you know, if it's poor people who are vulnerable, and it's true, if they're white, if they're black, if you're in the way of some economic plan, that especially some expansion of something or the other, you're gone if you don't have the power to organize.
Let's take a call right now from Beatrice in Berea, in the Berea community. Hi, Beatrice. Welcome to the Mark Steiner Show. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm glad to speak for the people of Berea. We are a community, longstanding community here in East Baltimore. We watch what happened in Middle East, and now I want to let you know it's happening to us. Yeah. We got excited because we were supposed to get a new school at Fort Worthington, school number 85. Choice of renovation or replacement, they said we're getting a new school. We went to the meetings that they made us aware of, and when we got there, we saw a plan that had the school changed totally. And we keep asking questions. We said, well, where's the recreation center? And they say, don't worry about it. We're going to let you know. And at the next meeting, we come back and we say, where's the recreation center? Matter of fact, I looked at the plan and saw no playgrounds. Saw they had put in an amphitheater and talked about having a bridge with running water outside of the school. And I'm like, what do we need that for? Why do we need an amphitheater in a residential area?
Beatrice, so who's leading that plan over there? Who's the developer?
I know the Parker, Grimm and Parker are the architects. This is from Baltimore City Public School. I know Family League is part of it. Don't know exactly who it is, but the people who are in charge of from Baltimore City School, the new 10-20-year plan, we're one of the year one schools that are getting renovated, so we're right. The first ones to go through this. So we go to the meetings and we say, well, we see this, but we need more playgrounds. Where's our playground? They took away the playground, totally. Our neighborhood only has one playground, and that's the playground around Fort Worthington School and the recreation center. So then we go back to the next meeting where we're told, oh, well, we can't talk about the specifics of what's inside the building. So once we get to the third meeting where they tell us the specifics of what's inside the building, we say, oh, the gymnasium is too small. We have 25% to 29% of our population is children, and we need access to more than that. In our recreation center, we have access to two gymnasiums, a computer lab, which the neighborhood, the community built. Berea Eastside built the computer lab, not Rexham Park.
Beatrice, I want to ask you, because we only have 1 minute left.
Oh, okay, 1 minute.
No, I want to ask you, why do you think this is happening the way that it's happening? Where the community doesn't have input.
Because they don't consider us viable. That, you know, when you build something that we aren't even interested in, you didn't consider us at all. So you just erase the recreation center off of your map, and every time we say we need what we need in our community, you don't validate our desires. You don't think we are of any value. And so if you can just come in and erase the recreation center, what makes us believe, and you told us don't worry, but you still erased it and didn't put it back, what makes us believe that you won't just come in and just erase our homes?
Beatrice, I thank you so much. I would love your call. We have to go to a break right now, but I do hope you can call and join us in a future conversation. Thank you so much. Once again, I'm Lawrence Brown, sitting in for Mark Steiner here on The Mark Steiner Show of WEAA 88.9 FM. This is the voice of the community.
Give me one reason to stay here, and I'll turn right back around. Said I don't want to leave you lonely. You gotta make me change my mind. Come away with me in the night. Come away with me and I will ride you.
Welcome back, welcome back. On our way to break, we heard Give Me One More Reason by Tracy Chapman, who was born on this day in 1964. And you just heard That's Come Away With Me by Norah Jones, who was born on this day in 1979. You're back on the flagship station of the mighty Morgan State, WEAA 88.9 FM. And we're having this really powerful discussion. Just really thank Beatrice for her call from Berea. Donald, you were saying as we were in break that, you know, something needs to change.
Right.
What did you mean by that?
They got to change the paradigm. One of the things that is interesting to me, we have developers who get TIFs and bonds and come in our community, and they come off of 85, 695, and 83 and all around, and they come in and they have these presentations they give to City Hall. However, that you know there's a pre-meeting that's already been taking place, so when they get to us, when we ever come down there, downtown to have a conversation about it, is already the deal is already worked out. But there's a disconnect between how you say community. You got to understand every time they say community, that does not include the poor neighborhoods. And it's interesting how the disconnect is so bad that even if EBDI is now have a new board, and I'm asking to see the board because they change board like they change hairstyles. And at the end of the day, none of them are connected to the community. They could care less what they're doing to the people. And when you say something about it, they always say we had a plan. I like when you said about the Charette. We were part of that. Conveniently, they forgot or lost those Charette, what people really wanted in their community, where they wanted trees were. And we spent, like I guess, 4 days on that. And it's interesting how, you know, when they disconnect, they come with their own plan. They come with an idea. And whenever they come to us and say to us, what do we want? We realize they're not listening to us at all. They have already listened to who they going, where they can get money from, and yet you hurt innocent people who historically, I like to say, people been in their homes for four generations, and it's sad that when they had to leave their home, where did they go? And most of the people, trust me, that moved out of East Baltimore are no longer living in any home, and they want to say they're crackhead cocaine users, but that's not true. You can't put me in a house that I cannot afford and expect me to live.
Absolutely. Now, Dee, since you mentioned two public housing developments, and we've touched on EBDI and the damage that they've done, I want to get into the fact that the Housing Authority of Baltimore City, when it was formed in 1937, it actually located public housing developments in places to reinforce residential racial segregation at the time, right? Including McCullough Homes, Somerset. You know, and the housing developments were actually segregated at the time. Like Poe Homes was Edgar Allan Poe Homes, not Poe Homes, but P-O-E, not P-O, right? But they were actually white at the time. And I believe Somerset started out as white public housing. So public housing started out as extremely segregating, had extremely segregating effect. And so even the dismantling of public housing, which became almost all black, so to dismantle that has a disproportionate impact. There was never any sort of restitution, reparation made when the Housing Authority of Baltimore City began to dismantle these housing developments. As a matter of fact, Joan Jacobson talks about between 1990 and I believe 2005, the Housing Authority of Baltimore City decreased the number of occupied homes by almost 7,000 units. So we're talking about this massive decline of livable communities, livable black communities, and people being displaced. Dr. Saunders, you were shaking your head. What comes to mind when you hear about this public housing dynamic?
Well, usually public housing, when it was even built, public housing was usually located in the most undesirable lands and things of that nature. So when public housing came down, even in Chicago, Baltimore, you know, across the U.S., residents were usually giving housing choice vouchers so that they can go, you know, choose the place that they would like to live. And that was the thought was that they would be able to achieve upward mobility with that. And, you know, the research is mixed on that. So, you know. It's a mixed bag.
It's a mixed bag. I want to go to the phones right now. We have Keith from Baltimore. You're on the Mark Saunders Show. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I am 62 years old today.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
And
I just like to say that 60, you know, at least 55 years of my raising in Baltimore City was over in East Baltimore near Johns Hopkins Hospital. And I am one of the victims of displacement and structural and institutionalized racism that Johns Hopkins has displaced on my communities ever since I was a child. And I really take offense at when I hear people say that my community was a slum. We have respectful. We have very respectful community when I was growing up in East Baltimore as a child. And I find it is structural and institutionalized racism that has always been a part of Baltimore City. And I find it interesting while they're building all up down on the Inner Harbor, they're building all up down there in South Baltimore and every section of the black communities all throughout Baltimore City has been neglected. But I also fault every black politician that is sitting in city council all the way back to Delisandro when he was mayor, because none of them really fought for their communities. And during the riots of the 60s, when the riots were going on during the 60s, this is all because it was a continuation of neglect. And I believe that Johns Hopkins Hospital was a key player in it. And I also believe, conspiracy-wise, that Johns Hopkins helped to put the drugs in that community to destroy the people.
Keith, we thank you for your call. We appreciate your insight. I do believe, at least on one point, it wasn't a conspiracy. You had the Broadway Redevelopment Project in the 50s, and you talked about this in your book, Maricela, mm-hmm. that displaced over 850 black families, over 1,000 families, mm-hmm. Almost 950 families altogether, but overwhelming majority were black. Mm-hmm. And then EBDI, of course, in the 2000s, which displaced 740 plus African-American families. So that's 1,500 families right there from one university that displaced. We got a tweet from Parag Kandahar that said, displacement equals losing all the places and memories that comfort you as you age. Mm-hmm. Added to multiple collective traumas, what violence? And Dee, you talked about that in your article, that you go back to the places where you grew up and they're gone.
I mean, you know, ironically, I just going back to some of the things the last caller touched on, there was a huge federal indictment before they tore Eggers Street down. It was 27 people in that indictment from that community and surrounding areas. And the paper wrote it up as if like they was called the Dickeyland Gang. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't even a gang. It wasn't a gang and it wasn't the kingpin. It was some riffraff, but it wasn't how they made it out to be. And one of the guys who caught the, you know, the wrong end of that was one of my best friends, a dude named Tavon Robinson. He got 27 years and he wasn't a violent person. He wasn't a violent guy at all. So, I mean, all these things, they fall into place. But I do think it's healthy for us, you know, to sit here and spark these conversations and have these arguments and talk about it and do what we can do as people to try to, you know, fix this. I don't think we'll see it in our generation, but I think if more people start, you know, I'm one person who, you know, I try to write articles and teach and do what I can do. But if other people start doing what they good at and we all collectively work together, then we can stop some of these issues. The key is to just not make opportunity exclusive. It's so easy for them to displace us and try to throw us away because they don't really see us as nothing but B-roll footage on, you know, on Channel 2 News. Right. All them crazy black guys with their automatic weapons and Ed Jordans and baby mothers. Like, they don't see us as people. What the caller said was real. Like, these are real communities of people who, you know, my son's a knucklehead. He got in trouble. Okay, I'm going to give him a job doing this, and we're going to help him get his life together. And now this person does this, and this person does that. You'd lose all of that stuff when you just blow these neighborhoods up and send people all over the place. So all of us have to figure out what we're good at and try to work together and do it so we can collectively make some type of change.
Yes, yes, yes. That's so powerful. I think about, you know, really there's when we talk about serial force displacement, mm-hmm. we have to go back to the 10s, 20s, 30s, and 40s where there was a long-lasting programs called slum clearance, right, mm-hmm. that were engaged in by the city. And a lot of times it was because of two things. They said there was a lot of crime in the black community and a lot of disease in mm-hmm. black communities, especially tuberculosis. So there's always a public health rationale and a criminal justice or a criminal rationale around why that took place. And that was almost 100 years ago mm-hmm. when that was taking place. And then after some clearance, we had urban renewal, which mm-hmm. came down the Housing Act of 1949, right? So urban renewal, and that took place, displaced another huge chunk of families. And now we have this urban redevelopment. So that's where we get to that nearly 15,000 black families. Mm-hmm. Dr. Saunders, D was just saying there's a different way we can do this. You talked about community engagement earlier. What are some of your thoughts around how communities can be engaged with urban planning?
Oh, definitely. So, you know, one of the things that community residents right now can do is making sure that they're going to the legislators' meetings and things like that. I know Baltimore is broken up into, I want to say, it's 9 different planning districts. I could be wrong about that, but they're broken up into different planning districts. Each of the planning districts has their own community planner. Make sure you know them. Ask them what's going on. Become more involved with your community development corporations that you may have in your neighborhood. Find out what they're doing. What other plans have been made either by the city or by other civic organizations. And make sure that your voice is heard. You have to participate to make sure that your voice is heard.
Absolutely. Well, let's go to the phones. We have Vernette from Baltimore. Welcome. You're on the Mark Steiner Show.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to speak to the success stories of East Baltimore. I grew up there. I attended Delbar High School. I learned how to become a program developer in high school. And I graduated. And I now have a bachelor's degree in computer science. So I'm just one of many success stories. So when I hear people kind of downplay the neighborhood or what kind of molded me as well as my friends, it kind of felt very, it's very discouraging, I guess, to the next generation, because we had more success stories that came out of that neighborhood than we did a lot of unsuccessful people. We have doctors, lawyers, engineers, politicians, and everything. And they all grew up with me. So I'm trying to understand how we, as, you know, the beneficiaries of the sacrifice of our grandparents and our parents, to kind of come back to the neighborhood and instill that same type of drive in the next generation. Within my one building, you know, with a lot of single mothers, my mother was single not because of my father doing anything outrageous, because he passed away. And now I was one of those stories. So my godsister graduated from Johns Hopkins with honors as a nurse. So I'm just trying to understand why when people kind of reference urban youth, they kind of not acknowledge those of us who have become very successful. And not necessarily in spite of, but because of. Everybody that nurtured us in that neighborhood. And you were definitely a very big part of the Chevette of Church Square. You went to church there. You went to school there. My mother was a professor at the Dunn College there. And that was really where I learned how to soar. And I just want to know how we, as now the adults in the community, who are kind of on the outskirts, because we all moved to the county, right? So it was something that was much better. And I recognize that it's not better, really.
Thank you, Vernette. Thank you for calling in on the Mark Steiner Show. D, you have a thought about that.
Yeah, I think everything Vernette said is, like, right on point. It's because we need to tell our own stories. When you look at these meetings, when you watch the news and when you read the newspapers, a young black person making out the projects, or a young black person rebuilding in their neighborhood, or a young person going to college, that's not these aren't the stories that they want to tell. They want to talk about this drug indictment, this federal case, that federal case. They don't. That's not the sexy 6 o'clock late breaking story, you know. So that's why I said, you know, it's important for us to, we have to reclaim journalism. We have to tell our own stories. We have to get our perspectives out there. And until we do that, or, you know, we'll never ever be considered until we do that.
Mm-hmm. Can I add that to that is there's an old Kenyan's proverb. Until lions have historians, hunters will be heroes. Mm-hmm. I think we've been living since the founding of the United States. We've been living the false reality of who the heroes are and the heroines are in this country, and that's determined by who gets to tell the story, who gets to build a social construct, who gets to put out the dogma and the mythology of who's good and who's bad. And we live in a society where black people are demonized, where dark skin is demonized. And the people with power are the ones who get to tell the story. They have the power to tell the narrative. Until recently, they've owned the airways. They've owned the media. They've owned all the resources that allow us to say what is going on in America and who's impacted. And like Dee said, until we reclaim and take back not just the airways but everything else, and certainly until we take back the community where we're not having to defend ourselves. You know, Dee shouldn't have to start his statement on the air defending what he wrote. He should be able to say, I wrote this because, and all these people who are still unfortunately ignorant because of the dogma of what white privilege had have allowed to say who are the good people and who are the bad people, we're still dealing with that dichotomy, that dualism in this society. And that same duality has caused our communities of color to fracture so that when we do want to organize, we have difficulty ourselves to get together and build trust with each other so we can be more powerful, so we can organize and engage, so we can hold the people accountable, so we can hold the black and the white politicians accountable. Mm-hmm. So we have to organize. You know, we have to define the reality that we live, not the reality that white America and power America has been telling us is real. We have to quit swallowing the lies and the perceptions, and we have to be forceful, powerful, and clear that our reality on the ground is as real as that reality that's trending publicly, so that we buy and we consume what the people with power want us to consume and believe is the thing to go after.
Mm-hmm. And I want to take a call, and we'll come right back to you, Dr. Saunders. Hank from Baltimore, welcome. You're on the Mark Saunders Show.
How you doing today, young man?
We're great. How are you?
And I say this quite often, right? We tend to blame a lot of people for a lot of things that we tend to do to ourselves, right? If we don't teach ourselves certain things will continue to come to us, right? They taking everything from us and not giving us nothing. And then we complain because they're not giving us nothing. When we don't collectively put together to keep something, even if you don't monetarily gain anything but knowledge, it is your right as a person to lay your history of who you are to the person who comes up underneath of you, so they'll have some kind of knowledge or worth at some point in time who they are, right? I can go back and show you how on my mother's side of the family, they've always owned property, right?
And on Hank, we're running out of time. I want to ask you what is the responsibility that the people who pass all these policies have? What responsibility do politicians have for all of these harmful, damaging policies?
Look, check this out, right? If you teach your child to get into a system where he's supposed to go, if you teach your child politics, right, or explain to your child politics, right, they go into politics, then they have a chance. If you teach your child it's okay to get up and have a job, instead of going out to hustle and get a piece of property, right, then you have some sense of community. If you go to the community meetings with your child and your child has community values.
Thank you, Hank. We appreciate your call.
And you buy your house and they still take it. And you buy your house and they can still take it. What's intimate domain? What's that? What that mean? You buy your house and they can still take it.
I just want to kind of pick up on a couple of threads that he was talking about. One, he's really talking about individual responsibility. Mm-hmm. What is our individual responsibility to improve our community? And I think that is something that needs to be talked about. Mm-hmm. We all have a sense of agency, that we as individuals have power that we can impact our lives. But there is a difference between things that you can do at the micro level and mm-hmm. things that need to be done at the macro level. And so when you're talking about crime and the justice system and how blacks are disproportionately put into prison for offenses that others might do the same thing and get a lighter sentence, like those things need to be taken control of at the macro level. And as far as his thing about like some of the things that we do to ourselves, that may be true, and I do think that we need to do more organizing, right, so that we are collectively together putting a strong front so that others know, and I'm talking about the powers that be, mm-hmm. that you can't just come into this community mm-hmm. and think you're just going to raise it. That's not going to happen because it's going to be one, hell of a fight. And so I think those, so those are things that we need to delineate. There are things that we can do at the micro level, and there are other things that need to be done at the macro level.
Right, and I want to highlight this point that both Dee and Donald were making, that, you know, eminent domain is enshrined in the Constitution of the United States, called the Takings Clause, right? And it empowers governments with the ability to confiscate your land, right, whether you own it or not. And I think, you know, personal responsibility can't defeat eminent domain. You're not going to personal responsibility your way out of the government taking your property when the government says it's time. Donald, I wanted you to tell, we talked about, you know, reclaiming our stories. What's your story? You lived in Middle East community. There's a school, Henderson Hopkins, that sits right where your home used to be. You know, what's your story that you want people to know about how you viewed that community and what's there now?
Thank you, Dr. Brown. Interesting to me, we were able to, because we had an idea when the lottery was 2 years ago. And so what we did, we put out 600 applications. First of all, we couldn't get the applications for the school. And we took many trials. We couldn't get it online. We couldn't go call anybody and ask anybody.
You're talking about Henderson Hopkins.
Henderson Hopkins School.
Right.
And it was interesting to me that I gave up my home, which was fine with me because I knew that our children would get an opportunity to have greater education. So it wasn't a problem. But when I look at where the glass door is and where my home was, it's just devastating to see that, yes, they have called, they put black children in the school for now, but I promise you in 5 years there won't be a black person in there, because the lottery is set up so that it's not even, in order to even get into the lottery, you got to make sure that your name is there. But if your name is not on it, you're on a waiting list.
Right.
In the meantime, it's in a black community. Let me talk about, you got 7 acres of land. You spent all this money, $42 million, into a school. And yet you can come in and land that in a black community and say, you cannot go there. If that ain't plantational, I don't know what it is. I don't, this difference between Jim Crow and this. Because at the end of the day, we need to be real. We don't talk about what the elephant is. We talk around it. And yes, I understand what the man said when he said that, oh, yeah, you know, we did these ourselves. However, what they know they're good at is divide and conquer. If you give me a crumb, you'll keep your mouth shut. But at the end of the day, they'll marginalize anybody that will come against the principalities in this world. But the interesting, we don't even want to talk about the elephant because we're intimidated by what he's supposed to be. All I know, he's got a lot of, he's talking loud, but he ain't saying nothing. But it's just sad to me. And when I look in the black community, when residents had fought for everything we ever got in the community. They said it was for Middle East. They said it was for the community. But we at the table literally had to fight for crumbs from the table. I think that's disrespectful to us.
So you're speaking back against the narrative that the community didn't take responsibility. That the community literally did fight for some of the changes that you saw in demolition, that the community fought for changes in the relocation process,
yes,
in the amount of money families received from the relocation benefit package, that you fought for that, right?
Yeah,
it wasn't just the community sitting back being lazy, eating bonbons.
And that's why I get kind of teed off when people think that we didn't do it. But when you got, like I said, when you got voices louder than yours, because they can marginalize what you say, are they in charge of the media conversation? They be able to outreach and say what really happened. After all the work we were able to do, even to safe demolition, it was the community that did that. And yet they're all over the country saying, this is how you do demolition. So it's sad that black communities still stood up to the plate. I would never say that we have created opportunity, but when they're able to peel off one by one because they can give them something that make them feel good. And I'm not saying being poor is a difficult place to be in, but it's sad that that's what they throw in your face. They give you the crumbs to keep your mouth shut.
Oppressors are very good at teaching victims how to blame themselves from being teaching victims how to blame themselves for being victims.
And it's called internalized racial oppression or internalized oppression when people do that. We have less than 2 minutes. So I want final thoughts as we leave. Dr. Gomez, what are your thoughts?
To piggyback what Donald is saying, the Brookings Institute put out a report in early 2000s that said when a community has more than 10% black, white people won't move in. Okay, now think about that. if this school was really built for the community, the only way that this school is going to serve the community that they really want, which is a white professional class of color professional class of people, they had to, with the intention in mind, they had to plan to make sure that that community is not going to be a high percentage of people of color. And the amount of money that's gone into this school, like Donald said, it's just a matter of time before all those pictures with black faces that they're putting on the school bus to represent Henderson Hopkins is going to change. The intention of this plan is not for the community, as has been the rhetoric of Casey Hopkins and EBDI.
We have less
city.
Than 1 minute. Dr. Saunders, what's your
Oh, I just
thoughts.
Want to go back to a previous point we talked about, taking control of our narrative. We know on the news, if it bleeds, it leads. So we really need more platforms like WEAA so that we can talk about our issues and come to a collective consensus on how to move forward.
Thank you. Dee, your final thoughts.
Attacking the system and trying to reform the system and, you know, pushing for change is not asking for a handout. It's getting what you deserve. You can fight. It's okay. And, you know, whatever happens, happens.
And Donald, your final thoughts.
I just want to say, they said on paper they made many promises. Just do what you said you were going to do on paper. That's all I'm asking.
And we thank our guests, Dr. Saunders, Dr. Gomez, Donald Gresham, Dee Watkins. Thank you for joining us in this hour. From school funding to testing, you can learn about the important issues impacting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. And as we go on the break, oh, it sounds like we're listening to my man, MC Hammer. Yes. Can't touch this.
Oh, I can't hear it.
WEAA 88.9 FM. It's Hammer's birthday. Y'all watch out there now. It's Hammer time.
Fresh new kicks and bands. You got it like that. Now you know you want to dance. So move out of your seat and get a fight going.